From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater, an hour of sounds from radio's golden age. I'm Jake Longwell. We'll open the hour with an episode of the Nelson Olmsted Playhouse, starring storyteller Nelson Olmsted. As far as I can determine, this is the only surviving episode of that series. From July 25th of 1946 on NBC, this is their adaptation of a very moving story by Stephen Vincent Benet. Elementals.
The Nelson Olmsted Playhouse. The National Broadcasting Company presents the Nelson Olmsted Playhouse, bringing to life the most powerful and compelling short stories ever written, and featuring America's master storyteller, Nelson Olmsted.
Good evening. The story the Playhouse Company and I have for you tonight was written by Stephen Vincent Benet. This is the story of a man and a woman and a piece of bread. And on that piece of bread, our couple were courageous enough to stake everything they had, even their love. This is the story of Elementals. The human soul is a house of many fantastic chambers. But for most of us, the most curious of these chambers are the least frequented. It is only the elemental forces of the naked and crying soul that will suffice to move the doors of these chambers. The elemental powers, fear, hunger, love, and hate. And this is just. Just that the doors should open seldom. For the man upon whom they have opened, even for an instant, will never be the same again. When young Sherwood Latimer accepted the invitation of his temporary employer, John Slake, to dinner for two, he had no idea of opening these doors. No, nor of encountering anything more elemental than a well-cooked meal. As he walked up Madison Avenue with his fiancée, Catherine Vane, toward the big, ugly Slake mansion, he felt no forewarning, no intuition of what was to come. It was any summer evening, he and Catherine, hand in hand, hating to part even for a little while.
Catherine, I wish you were coming to Slake's, too.
So do I. I'm hungry.
Where will you eat?
Oh, in my room. It's cheaper. I'll boil an egg and open a can of sardines.
Well, I sit down the guinea hen under glass.
Oh, don't worry about me. Eat lots, darling. You'll see.
You're a fine one to talk. In this half light, you look almost transparent. Like a beautiful ghost. Mm-hmm. Oh, Catherine, I do love you.
Yes, Sherry.
I've got to get out of that grimy office. If we only had some money.
Oh, will you be making more this fall with your assistant professorship?
More, but not enough. Not enough for us to marry.
Well, maybe after this year.
Yes, another year of waiting. Oh, Catherine, I want so much for us. I want it now.
I know. What does Mr. Slake want with you? He's never asked you to dinner before.
I don't know. To talk about the Guicciardini translation, I did, maybe.
Maybe he wants you to do another.
That is, we need the money, I'd hate to. I don't like him, Catherine. He's like some gigantic cat, sleep, purring. Yet there's always the tiger there underneath, ready to spring.
I'd like to meet him.
I wouldn't want you to. I don't know whether it's his money that gives him that sense of power or what, but when I'm around him, I feel as if I'm nothing more than a match stem. He could twist me, crush me, do whatever he wanted with me.
They had come now to the big, frowning Slake residence. In the shadows, two ever-present private detectives stood guard. Recognizing Latimer, they nodded. For a moment, he stood holding tightly to Catherine's hand. Then he turned and walked quickly up the steps. She watched until the big wrought iron doors clanged behind him, and he was swallowed up in the recesses of the gloomy old house. Dinner with Slake was a ritual. He spoke little. All through the 7 courses, the younger man kept thinking, he wants something from me. I can feel it. Why doesn't he say what it is? But it wasn't until coffee was served that Slake settled over his back in his chair and began to talk.
I've just been over your Guicciardini translation, Latimer. Excellent. Excellent.
Why, thank you, sir.
Not at all. I find it rather surprising, though, that you should be so at home with a man like Guicciardini.
Why, sir?
Because you're a romantic, Latimer. I can tell by the look of you. Thin, shabby, intense. Whereas your friend Guicciardini was a consummate realist.
He was a cynic, completely devoid of any kind of human feeling.
Precisely. And because he was without emotion, he could understand better than most the forces that rule this curious sideshow we call human existence.
What forces?
The elementals. There are only 3. 3 prime movers in this vagrant piece of oddity we call the soul. Fear, hate, hunger.
What about love? I mean real love. The love of a man for a woman.
Bosh, my friend. It's pure bosh. There are 3 elementals and only 3. Fear, hate, hunger. Put love up against any of them. Against hunger. I'll give you an example of your love put to a test from Guicciardini. Your translation of it was flawless. It's in the chapter on the merry diversions of Prince Alessandro. You remember? There were 2 lovers in Alessandro's court, you'll recall. Like you, they too believed in the magic power of love. And Alessandro decided to put this love to a test. If they won, the young man was to have a dukedom. If they lost, they would both be executed. Unfortunately, the test was by hunger. Elemental hunger. For 10 days, the lovers were locked up in adjoining rooms. A strong glass partition between them so that they could see each other suffering but could not communicate. They were given water lest they die of thirst and spoil the experiment. Water but no food. On the 10th day, the glass partition was removed and 1 piece of bread thrown in. You know the rest.
Yes, I know.
Hunger won. Won over love. Guicciardini writes that the lovers had entwined themselves into a deadly knot in their death grapple for that 1 small piece of bread.
Alessandro was a mad monster, a fiend. It wasn't a fair test. Starvation, slow starvation, and then suddenly giving them food. They lost their heads. It was too hard.
Wait. If love is stronger than hunger, no test is too hard. I think that I have proved my point.
No. No, you haven't.
Would your love be big enough, Latimer? Would it?
My... Why... I don't know. It's preposterous. Such a thing couldn't happen now.
But suppose it could. Would you put your love to such a test?
Yes. Yes, I would.
You are absolutely sure of yourself and the lady in question?
Yes, I am.
Then suppose we try it.
What are you talking about?
Now, wait. You haven't heard the stakes. All I would ask is that you sign a written contract that if you should lose, you would give up your present teaching career and put yourself at my disposal for the next 10 years.
Are you serious?
From the young lady, I should require nothing. The loss of your career and the humiliation would be quite sufficient to make you both wholly miserable if you did marry. Now, should the test be withstood successfully, and I would not require of you a longer period than 20 minutes to be confronted with a piece of bread after your starvation. Should you both refuse the bread, a check of $10,000 would be delivered to you that same day. $10,000, Latimer.
Your proposition is ridiculous. This is the 20th century.
The 20th century. Exactly. The century of centuries where money is power. I have $10,000, Latimer. 100 times 10,000. And you are without any funds at all. If you will pardon my saying so. Now, On the third floor of this very house, Latimer, there's a little suite of soundproof rooms. We could carry out our little experiment there in perfect peace. The young lady could have one room, you another. I would have a window cut between so you could observe one another. And, of course, I would visit you twice a day.
Mr. Slake, I'm very tired.
You'll have no food, of course, but all the water you wished. And in consideration of the fact that neither of you possesses a Renaissance physique, I would be perfectly willing to shorten the period of starvation to 7 days. I can see at last you're interested. You accept?
Of course not.
You amaze me. $10,000. You'll never have another chance like this in all your life.
I'll be frank with you, Mr. Slake. I do need the money. If you'd made your insane offer to me alone, perhaps... But as it is...
Of course, the young lady. By the way, I hope you will give my sincerest congratulations to the lady of your choice. To Miss...
Vane. Catherine Vane.
Vane? Not one of the Newport Vanes.
Oh, you wouldn't know her. She works at Columbia in the secretary's office. She... What are you doing? What are you writing on the tablecloth?
No, nothing, Miss Latimer. Nothing. Just a little reminder. You see, I have a whim. A whim of wishing to meet Miss Vane in person.
Slake, don't you go to her with it. I forbid it.
Ah. You're afraid, Latimer. Afraid she might agree.
She's the one woman I know who would have the courage. Slake, I beseech you, if there's any good in you, let us alone. Let us alone.
Wallpaper was covered with bluebirds.
Five.
21 bluebirds to each wall.
Six.
Latimer knew. He'd counted seven, them so many times. To stop the counting, Latimer dug his teeth
nine,
into the flesh of his wrist. The sudden sharp pain was good. For a minute, it relieved the other pain. The dull, thick pain in the pit of his stomach. The gnawing pain that never went away. And then, suddenly, as if waking from a dream, he jerked his arm from his mouth... For a long time, he sat stupefied, looking at the little white dents his teeth had made in his wrist. An uncontrollable shudder went over his body.
No. It's impossible. I couldn't have come to that stage yet. It's only the fourth day. The fourth day of the fast.
Three more days. He knew it was three because Slake came twice a day and already he'd been in seven times. As soon as it was dark, he would come again. That would make eight times. Two into eight makes four. 4 days, only three more to go. 3 more days of this torment. And then the test.
The test? Suppose I fail her. Suppose I snatch the bread from her. Fight her for it. Suppose... Oh, God. Why did we listen to that madman?
After Slake had talked to Catherine, there had been no stopping her. She'd made it sound so easy. Latimer remembered how easy she made it sound.
Why, Sherry, darling, just think. It's everything we want. Everything. And it's ours if we only have the courage to take it.
And I will be kinder to you than Alessandro was to his couple. I will allow each of you 3 books. The Bible, the Koran, the Gita.
Good. We can make a comparative study of religions in our spare time.
Yes. In your spare time. You'll have one inconvenience, though, I fear. I cannot allow either of you soap or toothpaste.
I understand. They're edible, aren't they?
They'd fooled Slake in one respect, anyhow.
Thanks to his giving them the books, they could talk to each other, pointing out what they wanted to say. He walked unsteadily across the room to the little window. She got up and came toward him, book in hand. It was the Bible. He smiled. He had a sentence for her in his Bible. He pointed it out.
The lions do lack and suffer hunger.
She shook her head with mock dolefulness and started turning leaves rapidly.
Happy shalt thou be, and it shall be with thee.
Her finger ran along the line.
Thy wife.
Oh, my dear. My dear.
Her mouth made a soundless darling. Latimer crawled across the room, sank back in the bed. Now to sleep.
Oh, God, please let me sleep. Don't let me think. Don't let me think about food.
Drowsiness came easily. Sleep was harder. In spite of himself, he dreamed of food. The walls of the room had turned to meat. He ate and ate, but as soon as he swallowed a morsel, it seemed to vanish into air. It never reached his stomach, and his jaws ached from chewing, chewing. Slake was there, eating deliberately, gluttonously. He could hear his jaws crunching, and all the time, Slake was urging him on.
Eat, Latimer. Eat, eat. Eat! Eat! Eat!
Good morning, Mr. Latimer. Oh, Mr. Latimer. My dear Mr. Latimer, I really am surprised. Teeth marks in the beautiful leather Bible cover. And what's this? The fly page missing?
No. No, I couldn't have. I couldn't have done it.
No wonder you're shocked. A man of your refinement eating paper. Why, your mouth is full of it. Disgusting. I must remove the books at once. I had forgotten they might be misapplied.
No, the books. Catherine and I, don't take the books. Don't take the books, please. Please.
But Slake was gone. Latimer got up with effort, looked in the mirror. His cheeks were hollower, eyes larger, clothes hard to put on, too many buttons, too hard. He began the long trip across the room to the little window. But pain took him up in its heavy, soft hands and squeezed him like fruit. He sat down. In a minute, he would go and see Catherine. Now he must rest. He tried to count the number of times Slake had been there to remember what day it was. But instead, it was bluebirds he was counting. Then, like an answer to prayer, a thought came to him. Slake would be here soon, and Slake would know what day it was. Only, if Slake knew he was confused, he wouldn't tell him. He had to trick him into telling him. Trick Slake.
Good morning, Mr. Latimer. Still no complaints?
Still no complaints. After all, it won't be for very much longer.
True, true. A mere question of hours, shall we say?
Hours. Hours. Yes. Hours.
Or shall we say days?
Days. Is it really days?
I'm afraid you'll have to puzzle that out for yourself.
Slake was gone. He still didn't know what day it was. Slake had tricked him. But wait, Catherine would know. He'd go and ask her. When he reached the window, he was drenched with sweat. He would have to sit down a minute.
He eased himself into the chair, shut his eyes. He was dreaming of all the food he'd ever eaten when the sound came somewhere near, like the noise of a moth beating itself against a lamp. He raised his head. Somewhere he'd heard that sound before. He dragged himself to his feet, gripping the windowsill for support. At the other side of the window was a face, a waxen face, and the face was trying to smile. It was trying to speak, too. But his mind was too blurred to read what it said with its soundless moving lips. All he knew was that the face was Catherine's. Catherine's. And she was starving to death. Suddenly she tottered.
Catherine.
Sank to the floor, a little white heap.
Catherine. Catherine. Catherine.
He fell back from the window and covered his face with his hands. He didn't know how long the fit of ugly weeping lasted. But when it was over, his mind, in spite of the intermittent burnings of fever, was quite composed. He knew what he had to do. After a long time, he heard Slake's key in the lock. He quieted himself with a straining effort. He must speak slowly and calmly.
I'm afraid I shall have to withdraw from the contest, Mr. Slake.
Really? When only a few more hours would have brought us to the most interesting part. May I ask why?
Catherine.
I see. You're afraid of the test to come. Afraid you might kill her for the food.
No. No, it's... I saw her. She fell.
Only fainted. I've just seen her. As to your quitting now, Latimer, if you'll recall our contract, neither party can be released without full written consent from the other.
Then go. Go and ask her.
I am sorry, Latimer, but Miss Vane refuses. And therefore, by the terms of the agreement...
You're killing her. You devil from hell.
Would you, Mr. Latimer? Would you? What an exhibition of temper. What a pitiful exhibition.
Then he flung Latimer from him as if he were made of paper and left the room. Latimer was alone now, alone with his hunger and that last glimpse of Catherine's face. Suddenly there was a quaking voice. Not his own, it couldn't be. That kept talking to itself.
Catherine. Food. Catherine. Food.
On and on, the voice in its monotonous gibberish. And then suddenly it was cursing somebody named Slake.
Devil from hell. Batman, let me out. Let me out. Give me food. Food, I tell you. Food. Food. Food.
Colors streaked before his eyes. Scarlet. And purple, and green, until at last the voice was silent and there was nothing. Nothing but a collapse and a broken piece, a piece so complete and sightless that he had only one thought.
I am dying.
Then somebody was carrying him like a great shattered toy along a smooth paneled corridor. He was being put down on something that yielded and was soft. For a long time he lay as a man might lie in warm water. After that measureless time, he turned his head and opened his eyes. He was lying on a couch in a room that was not the room in which he'd been tortured. 3 steps away from him was another couch. A figure lay on the couch, a woman. His eyes regarded her incuriously. After another long time, a faint prickling began to work on him. It ran all over him like the feet of a small, rapid animal. Then it settled, began to gnaw. He remembered now. He was hungry. That was it.
Food. Food.
There is the food on the floor for you. Eat it.
He raised himself with an immensity of effort. His eyes looked at the space between the 2 couches. There was something on a plate, something white and solid.
Bread. A piece of bread.
The figure on the couch had stirred now, too. It raised itself on an arm, its great eyes staring at the bread. Then its eyes lifted from the bread and looked into his without recognition. His muscles tensed. The thing on the couch had seen the bread. It wanted the food as much as he wanted it. For a long time, they lay there eyeing each other suspiciously like starving dogs over a bone. And then, slowly, like a thief, Latimer slid down from the couch. His hand reached out and touched the bread. He shivered.
Bread. Good bread.
Now, the woman on the couch made a tiny despairing sound. Who was she? This strange, gaunt woman who was too weak to come down and fight him for the bread? Well, after he'd eaten, he would find out who she was, but not yet, not yet. Lust for the bread possessed him. His fingers closed over it. In a moment, he would feel the first sweet taste of it on his tongue. His hand began to go to his mouth, and then...
Who are you? Do you want my bread, too? You can't have it. It's mine.
The bread was almost in his mouth now.
Sure.
He drew it away and looked at the strange woman. She knew his name. Huh? How did she know it?
Sherry, dear. I'm so hungry.
Then there was a soft, bright shock in his mind. The whole room seemed to right itself as if it had been swinging upside down in space. It was Catherine, that lean, worn figure on the couch. Catherine, his Catherine, and she was hungry. Holding the hand with the bread in front of him, he began the immense journey across the floor to the other couch. Catherine was hungry. He must feed her. That was all. It was lucky somebody had left that piece of bread on the floor. He reached her side, rose clumsily to his knees. His arms went around her shoulder. One hand settled and was at rest in the curls of her hair. The other hand held the bread to her mouth.
Bread. Good bread. Eat it. Catherine, darling.
No. No, Sherry. You eat first. You're hungrier.
Time. Time's up. It's over. The test is over. Don't you understand? You've won. You've won your $10,000. Pick up the bread. Eat it, you fools. Eat it!
But they were not listening. They'd forgotten Slake and the $10,000. They'd even forgotten the piece of bread. They were holding each other close.
Catherine, I do. I do love you.
Yes, Sheriff. Yes.
Dramatization of a short story by Stephen Vincent Panay entitled Elementals. Now, here again is your host, Nelson Armstead.
Well, our story tonight was adapted for radio by Virginia Wells and directed by Herbert Lateau. Sherwood Latimer was played by Everett Clark, Catherine by Muriel Bremner, and Slake by Wilms Herbert. The orchestra was under the direction of Joseph Colicchio with original music by Emil Soderstrom. This has been another in our series of programs which features some of the most powerful and dramatic short stories ever written, and we hope you've liked it. 2 weeks from tonight, we have a story for you by Albert Wetjen. It's called Fortitude. And after hearing it, I think you'll agree with me that it's one of the most compelling sea stories ever written. In the character of the first mate, who through sheer force of will keeps his men alive on a barren island, you meet a person you won't forget. It's a good story, so try to be with us. Until then,
This is Nelson Armstead saying good night and good reading.
This program was a Chicago production. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
The Nelson Olmsted Playhouse and their adaptation of Stephen Benet's Elementals from July 25th, 1946 on NBC. This would not be the only time that story would be adapted for radio. Anthony Ellis directed an equally outstanding performance of Elementals for Escape, starring Tony Barrett, Georgia Ellis, and William Conrad. That episode aired on October 11, 1953, on CBS. It's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And our blog and website can be found at qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. You are listening to program number 1918. We'll conclude the hour with an episode of the series Crime Does Not Pay, a syndicated radio series running from November 7th of 1949 through April 4th of 1951, making for a total of 78 episodes. This broadcast, program 9 in the series, was released for syndication on December 5th of 1949, and features in the cast Jackson Beck. Here is A Piece of Rope.
Crime does not pay.
Yeah, I'll take Lobster Diavolo every time. Nothing like it. Boy, that red sauce.
Sure, it ain't the spaghetti fill on account of it looks like rope.
Yeah, could be. Why you use a rope all the time, Phil? A gun or even an ice pick would be quicker. Like today, Puggy almost got away.
Yeah, maybe Dookie's got something, Phil. Look how that jerk bit my hand.
That's because you're slipping, Tiny. You didn't used to have to stick your hand in their mouths.
Well, that still don't answer Dookie's question.
Yeah, Phil. Why a rope all the time? It's simple, like ABC. We all got records, ain't we? And you carry a loaded piece, when you got a record, it's another felony, ain't it? Carrying concealed weapons, see? Well, I've been wise to the flat feet since I've been a kid. And nobody can prove in no court that you had a weapon on you when all you're carrying is a piece of rope.
In the interest of good citizenship and law enforcement, we present Crime Does Not Pay, based on the famous Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer series of short subjects. In just a moment, you will hear A Piece of Rope, starring Cameron Mitchell as Dookie DeFore. Crime Does Not Pay, starring Cameron Mitchell as Dookie DeFore in A Piece of Rope. There is a school of thought among the men whose job it is to fight organized crime that the old method of searching for clues and obtaining convictions on such evidence is not nearly as effective as attacking from within the organization itself by the use of informers. A typical case is that which involved Dookie DeFore and the gang which made its headquarters in a certain city at the corner of Warrenburg and Paoli Avenues. This organization serviced other groups. They accepted commissions to do certain jobs, as they did on the day Jack Paris told them...
Like I said, this Puggy Jackson is getting too smart for his own good.
Like, for instance, what?
You ask too many questions sometimes, Pittsburgh. Why don't you behave nice and quiet, like Dookie here?
Oh, Dookie, the kid's got a lot to learn yet.
He'll learn working with you. Only don't teach him to ask too many questions.
Sorry, Jack, I was only asking on account of if we know what he's pulling, we can find him easier.
You'll find him. That's what I'm paying you for.
Sure, we'll get him okay.
They call him Puggy on account of his nose. Some two-bit punk flattened it for him. Now I want him flattened. Complete.
Yeah, we'll take care of him.
Sure, we'll take care of him. And nobody, see? The bulls know he's been trying to cut me out. I don't want nothing to point to me.
When we get through, there won't even be a grease spot.
And it's a deal?
Yeah, sure is.
Sure is, Mr. Parrish. Sure is. Okay, you got the contract. Just be sure you carry it out. Understand?
Hey, Phil. Phil.
Yeah, Dookie.
Telephone, back of the store.
Okay, I'm coming.
Who is it?
Wouldn't say. You just asked for Pittsburgh Phil.
Know the voice?
Sounds a little like Mr. Parris.
He got ants in his pants again.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Well, if we can't find the jerk, we can't take care of him.
You know Parris. He thinks he's a big executive.
Yeah, I know. Pittsburgh Phil here.
What's wrong with you guys? Do I have to take my business someplace else?
Well, take it easy. We'll get him.
I've been waiting 3 weeks. He hijacked me again last night.
We can't do nothing until we find him.
Not find him. I'll give you 3 days.
What's he want? Blood out of a stone.
Yeah, I thought he was sore.
That don't get him nothing. You give us 3 days.
We gotta find that Puggy.
We'll find him. Tiny's making a contact today.
Tiny, that fat overstuffed...
When you get as smart as Tiny or as strong, you can talk.
Okay, Phil. I didn't mean nothing.
Don't bother me now. Okay. I gotta think. Go snatch a car or something. We'll need one for this job anyhow.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, sure. So when?
I wonder if you could give me some information.
You hear that, Dookie? He comes to the corner of Warrenburg and Paoli for information.
Yeah. That is, I was told I could find Tiny Schultz around here.
Where do you want Tiny?
I owe him some money.
So Tiny's still Shylocking. What do you know? Well, I'm sure I don't know where Tiny is, but if you let me have what you owe him, I'll see that he gets it.
No, I'm very sorry. I got to see him personal.
And who shall I say came calling?
Tell him Puggy Jackson.
Puggy Jackson. Now that I come to think of it, I think I know where he might be.
That's good.
Yeah, it's good. Tell you what, Dookie.
Yeah, right here.
Take this gentleman around to Tiny's usual resorts, and if you don't find him, bring the gentleman to my place in 3/4 hour. I'm expecting Tiny there then.
Gotcha.
I don't like to put you to so much trouble.
Any pal of Tiny's is a pal of mine. It's no trouble at all. In fact, pal, it'll be a pleasure to know you better.
Josie, the rest of us girls, well, I think you ought to know how lucky we think you are.
Lucky? Me?
Uh-huh, your own house, a fur coat, and Phil's about the sharpest husband we ever saw.
Oh, I don't know, Ellen, he's like most husbands, I guess. Always dropping things that you got to pick up after him. But I will admit, Phil's anything but stingy.
What business is Phil in, darling?
Contracting, dear.
You mean like road building?
Oh, goodness, no. Now, I'm sure that's one business Phil never wants to get mixed up with.
Well, what then, darling? To be perfectly frank, Josie, the girls were wondering, and I said I'd ask you. Seeing as how I know you best, that is.
Well, I don't know if I can describe it exactly, but he takes orders and does things for people, kind of a service company.
But what kind of a company?
Look, why don't you ask him yourself, honey? That's his key in the door.
Hiya, girls.
Hiya, darling.
You know Tiny, Josie, Ellen, this is Tiny. Tiny Schultz.
Hiya, Josie. Hello, Ellen.
Of all people to call Tiny, for goodness sake.
Sure. Anybody over 250, they call Tiny. And skinny guys, they call Fatso.
Yeah, you really over 250, Tiny.
300 if it's a pop.
Nothing small about this character. Look, Josie, some of the boys are coming over in a few minutes.
Okay, Mr. Mayor. What is it tonight? Poker or talk?
Talk, mostly.
Well, don't make a mess.
How can talk make a mess?
Oh, you don't know Phil's gang in their gab fest. Get your hat, dear.
I didn't wear any.
We'll go to a movie, Phil.
Yes, good idea. Here's a fin. Treat the girl, Phil.
Oh, thanks, dear. Come on, Ellen.
Well, I... Goodbye, all.
Goodbye.
So long.
Remember what I said, dear. No mess now.
What a dame. What a dame. Well, let's get going, Tiny. Duke, you'll be here with the jug in 10 minutes.
The usual?
Yeah, straight chair next to the door, big chair facing it.
Yeah.
That way, when the door opens, you'll see only you and I can get him from behind.
Yeah. How's this?
Okay, sit down and read that newspaper.
How am I doing?
Swell.
What are you using?
Here it is, Tiny, the usual. 4 feet of brand new wash line. Now all we got to do is wait.
This the place?
Huh? Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is it, Mr. Jackson.
Not bad. Very nice, in fact. It's kind of quiet.
Oh, they'll be there. Phil said so.
You sort of like this fella, don't you?
He's the best. The best. Let me ring the bell for you.
Come on in. Door's open.
We're coming. Go ahead, Mr. Jackson. After you.
Oh, thanks, kid. Tiny.
Come in, Puggy. Been waiting for you. Guys, all right.
Give me a hand. Get on him, Tiny.
I'm trying. He's stronger than I thought, this chicken.
Duke, lend a hand. Don't make me feel. Don't make me scared. No. Couch. Yeah. Get him on the couch.
Yeah. All right. Twist it. Twist the rope.
I'm trying. Stuff his mouth. Stuff it. He's making too much noise.
Yeah. He's got a mouthful of fist. Twist it, Phil.
Sit on him. Hold him down.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does it. Brother, this character was strong. Hey, he's dead.
Yeah, he's dead. Look what the dog did to my hand. That fella could get my jaw from a bite like that. You got any mercurochrome, Phil?
Iodine's better.
No, it stings too much.
Well, go look in the medicine chest. Josie's got all kinds of junk in there.
I hate iodine. Hope she's got mercurochrome.
Ain't got my wind back yet. Maybe I'm slipping.
Nah, you ain't slipping, Phil. You done fine.
Dookie, get some of that newspaper, quick.
You gonna read the paper?
Give me it, will you?
Hey, Ed McGurricrope. What are you doing, laying him out in steak?
You heard Josie when she left. No mess on the rug, she said. It's all I need now, trouble with my wife.
You ain't gonna leave him here like this, are you, Phil?
You got the car? No, I didn't have no time. I was taking him around the back.
You can use mine. Mine for the night, anyway.
Okay, roll him up. The rest of the rope is under the couch.
Yeah. Here's the keys, Dookie. Go out and start the engine.
Thanks.
I'll have the car ready by the time you come out. Okay, usual way, Tiny. Knees up, head down. Put him in a ball. He'll burn better that way.
Good. How's that, Phil?
Good. Stay at the wheel. Come on, Tiny.
Got the gasoline?
Yeah, right here.
Boy, it's quiet out here.
And Dookie and me, we was riding around. We spotted these empty lots. You got them?
By the rope, like a satchel. Funny how a guy who weighs so little could be so strong.
Yeah, this good enough. Now the gas.
That ought to bring some.
Okay, got a match?
Yeah. Here it goes.
Come on, let's get out of here.
All set, Phil?
Yeah, get going.
Hey,
don't he make a pretty bonfire?
In just a moment, Crime Does Not Pay will continue with A Piece of Rope. Now, we continue with Crime Does Not Pay, starring Cameron Mitchell as Juki DeFore in A Piece of Rope.
Bert, Phil, and Tiny left the flaming body of Puggy Jackson was covered with weeds and sumac and littered with tin cans. Half a block away was a row of small houses. From one of those houses came a boy of 16 or so to watch the crackling bonfire. From the back door of another house came Emma Adams, in her hand a pan of water for her dog. Emma saw the flames and the boy standing there. Angrily, pan of water and all, she descended on the boy.
How dare you start a bonfire here? I ought to call the police.
Oh, honest, Miss Adams, I didn't start it, honest.
Just like all boys your age, do things before you think. When those weeds catch, they'll set fire to the sumac bushes. Everything's dry as a bone. The whole neighborhood could burn down for all you care.
But I didn't do it. I was just watching.
Oh, that's what you all say. I'm going to put it out.
Okay, put it out. See if I care.
All right. There.
Hey, there's something in that fire. It ain't wood. Miss Adams, stop it. Hey, cut it out, Miss Adams. Somebody will think I hit you. Hey, stop.
What's going on here? What are you up to, young fella?
It's not me. There in the fire.
Officer, a dead man in the fire. In the fire.
Oh, for the love of... Stop that yelling now, lady. You're safe, I tell you. Young fella, get to a phone quick now. Call the precinct. Tell them Officer Martin told you. Give him the address. Run now, run. There ought to be a radio car close by.
Weiner, stick with the medical examiner. Let me know when he's through.
Check, Lieutenant.
Now then, Martin. Like I said, Lieutenant, I heard the lady screaming just as I finished talking to the desk sergeant from the car box up the block, so I beat it over here, and you know the rest, sir. I wish I did. This the lady, Martin?
Yes, sir. Mrs. Adams, this is Lieutenant McKenzie, 51st Precinct.
Oh, yes, sir.
You live around here, Mrs. Adams?
Yes, sir. That house, just the edge of the lot.
And as I understand it, you saw the flames and came over here.
Yes, I was so angry. I saw that boy standing here.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he started it, and it's so dangerous in dry weather. I had some water for Skippy, that's my dog. I threw it on the fire. Oh.
And that's all you know?
Yes, sir.
You hear or see any automobiles just before you saw the fire?
No, sir, I couldn't have. I was in the kitchen with the water running and all.
You, son, you see a car of any kind?
I think I heard a car. I'd see it. Do you know who he is?
No, not yet, son, but we will. Yes, Weiner.
The M.E. says he was killed and brought here. Strangled. Rope was deep in his neck. Fire didn't reach it.
Oh, can I? That is, may I?
Yes, Miss Adams, you can go. We'll call you if we need you.
Oh, thank you, Lieutenant. Thank you.
Any chance to identify Weiner?
Plenty. His face is okay, and they had his hands inside his legs, so we ought to get fingerprints.
Well, what do you know? A break. All right, tell the boys in the meat wagon they can have him, and we'll see him at the morgue in half an hour.
We got the girl outside, Lieutenant. I showed her the ring we got from him, and she came quick enough.
What's her name?
Jean Jackson. Her brother is Puggy.
It's Puggy. Fingerprints checked downtown. We better have complete identification anyhow. The D.A. likes it that way. Bring her in.
Check, Lieutenant. All right, Miss Jackson, this way.
Yes, Mr.
This is Lieutenant McKenzie.
Sorry to bring you down here this late at night, Miss Jackson, but if this is your brother...
It's his ring. Father gave it to him, had it made. I begged him, but he wouldn't listen.
They never do until it's too late. This way, please.
Do I have to see him?
Someone from the family must make an identification if you'd prefer your father.
My father's dead. Mother just couldn't. I hope she never needs to know.
If you'll do what's necessary, I think that'll be enough.
What's necessary?
Identify, then swear to it on the witness stand when we get the gang that did it. Fourth and the left, Weiner.
Check.
But if I go on the stand... The newspapers.
Maybe you won't have to do it. If you do, maybe we can get papers to forget your share. This is it, Miss Jackson.
I can't.
Lift the sheet, Weiner.
Check.
You'll have to look, Miss Jackson. You'll have to.
Yes. It's Puggy.
All right, we're going to close it up then. Give me a hand with the girl. Why do they always faint? Does it do any good? So what have we got, Wiener? What have we got?
We got a body, period.
We haven't got that anymore, literally speaking. It was released for burial yesterday.
Then we got a funeral to go to. Watch.
What for? I know who'll be there.
And you know more than I do.
The mother, the sister, a few relations, Pittsburgh Phil Stone, Tiny Schultz, Dookie Dufour.
How do you figure that?
Their handwriting is all over the job. And the method. The attempt to dispose of the body, the rope especially. Those boys know you can't prove a rope is in violation of the concealed weapons law. They never carry guns.
Oh, smart.
Very. But if we start the idea that they did it...
But why? Puggy never worked in that district.
They were hired, as usual.
Go on.
They have a weak sister in their outfit.
Huh. Weak or not, I'd hate to turn my back on any one of them in an alley.
Except Dookie...
Kid?
Right. I've got an idea, Wiener. Dookie doesn't know us. He's never seen either of us. Come along, Wiener. We're going for a little ride out to the corner of Warrenburg and Paoli Streets.
Okay, Wiener, pull over and park. Leave the engine running.
Check, Lieutenant. Watch yourself, Lieutenant.
Don't worry, I'm a big boy now. Don't move, Dookie.
What?
Be letting you back, Dookie. You're through, kid. You're through.
Oh, I didn't do nothing. Honest, I didn't.
Don't look behind you. You do, and you'll never see anything again.
Oh, now, please, honest.
Shut up. Do like I tell you. See that black car across the street?
Yeah.
Okay, start walking nice and easy, just as if you were going for a ride.
How are we doing?
On schedule, sir.
Don't rush. We don't want no trouble with cops.
What? No trouble?
You heard me, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. Look. What? Why don't you say something? I never seen you before.
Puggy Jackson never saw you either.
Who's Puggy Jackson? Look, where are we going? Where are you guys taking me?
What do you care? You're not coming back.
Look, I didn't do nothing. All I did was take orders. You can't blame me if something went wrong.
We got a job to do, that's all. You understand that, Dookie.
Yeah, sure. Look, I got some dough. I got it stashed. You can have it if you let me go. All of it. Nobody will ever know. I'll disappear. Change my name. You can tell your boss you took care of me. I never did nothing, I tell you. Nothing. Just, I was the driver is all. But I never touched anybody. Not even Puggy.
You hear that, Joe? He says he never touched Puggy.
He says. But I didn't. So you are some of Puggy's boys. But I never touched him. I just drive the car after. Just after I drove the car. Look, I'll give you the door, like I said. If you let me live, see? I want to live, you see? And I'll do more. I'll think of the others for you. I'll show you. Pittsburgh Phil and Tanny Joe.
They did it. I watched them. They did it. They did it, I tell you. I never laid a hand on them. Honest.
You got to believe me. Say something, will you? Don't just sit there like a statue or something with a gun in your pocket. Say something. I'll play ball. I'll play ball. Yeah. I'll finger him for you. I know lots. More than anybody thinks. Say something. Please, you gotta let me go.
Should I tell him, Joe?
Yeah, tell him. Put him out of his misery.
Okay, might as well.
No, don't shoot. Let that gun alone. Don't take it out, please.
No gun, Dookie. Just my hand in my pocket. Cops never carry guns in their pockets. They might catch it in the lining.
You. Cops?
Yes. Want to see our badges, Dookie?
Cops. I spilled my guts to cops.
You want to live, don't you, Dookie?
What do you mean?
You want to fry, Dookie?
Fry?
Try? No. No, no, I'll talk. Oh, I'll talk plenty. I want to live. Tell me I can live if I sing. Please, please tell me.
Down the radio, Wiener. Tell him to pick up Pittsburgh Phil and Tiny Schultz and turn back. We'll take this punk in with us.
Check, Lieutenant.
Here we go, Doogie. After you sing, home to Mama.
No, you can't do that. I'll talk. Oh, I'll talk, but you got to give me protection. I can't go home. I wouldn't live a day, not if I talk. One way or the other, I'm done. You got to protect me. I'll tell. Everything I know, I'll tell you. But you got to help me. You got to give me protection. I want to live. You got to help me. If I help you, you got to help me. You got to.
Cameron Mitchell, who was starred as Dukie DeFore in A Piece of Rope, will be back with you in just a moment. Now, here in person is Cameron Mitchell.
Well, I think it's obvious to everyone that Dukie DeFore became a criminal not so much of his own free will as because of the conditions into which he was born and the friends he made who came into existence in the same poverty-stricken slum areas where Dukie himself first saw the light of day. It follows then, at least to my way of thinking, that a certain responsibility rests upon all of us more fortunate citizens. Our own complacence, even the shameful little thrills we get when we read of murders and other sadistic crimes in our daily papers, tend to encourage, rather than uproot, the organized crime which has such a tight grip on so many phases of our national life. And in the last analysis, it falls on us, even more than on our police, to prove to one and all that crime does not pay.
Thank you, Cameron Mitchell. Crime Does Not Pay is written by Ira Marion and directed by Mark B. Loeb, with music composed and conducted by John Gart. Technical advisor is Burton B. Turkus. The events, characters, and names used in the story you've just heard are fictitious. Any similarity is purely coincidental.
Crime Does Not Pay, a syndicated radio series from the late 40s and early 50s, A Piece of Rope, Program 9 in the series, from December 5th of 1949. And with that, we come to the end of this hour of Old Time Radio. My name is Jake Longwell. Thank you, as always, for joining me. I sincerely hope you enjoyed my selections. Please join me again when you can for another hour of sounds from radio's golden age. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.